So I'm really excited to be here today, y'all. I got to take a tour of the facility. Lauren, thank you so much for the tour. It was awesome. Lauren and Erica gave me a tour of the facility, gave Kendall and I a tour. Hey! I got theme music, too, y'all. This is good. That's how big time I am. I got my own entrance song. That's good. Thanks, Chris. I appreciate that, man. What was that song, by the way? I'm going to use it, man. Good stuff. But this facility is special, y'all. It's special because of the amount of care they put into it. And I got to take a tour of the place and see where the infants and mothers go. And everything around here is so clean. And that's something that's really important. That's a culture thing because that comes from the top down. You know, we take care of our homes if we're taught to take care of our homes. I've been to a lot of places, y'all, where it's not as clean as this. And so that's something I was very impressed about. Y'all are doing a great job here. Thank you. Thank you for having me today. Thank you for showing me around. So I've got this story to tell y'all today. It's a two-part story. The first part is one we all know. It's about the dangers of drugs, consequences of bad decisions. It's about addiction and the pitfalls of addiction. You know, addiction affects everybody in this country. I don't care if you're the addict going through it or the family member of the addict. And the family members get it the worst. I gave it to my parents with both barrels, y'all. I gave them hell. Or the victims that we create along the way. I created a trail of victims in my wake, and you're going to hear all about that, to support my habits. Or you're just a taxpayer paying into an overburdened criminal justice system that has no idea how to handle the disease, because it is a disease, of addiction. There's two things in this country we have to change our attitudes towards. It's mental health and substance abuse, y'all. And I think we're making strides. I think we're going that way, but we're not quite there yet. So I want to get into this story, y'all. Let's start this story out. Let me get through that. July 30th, 2008. I'm sitting around this little rundown apartment in Dallas, Texas, and it's just a little meth house where I live 11 years ago. I'm sitting around this little rundown couch, and I'm smoking meth with this guy named Tex, my meth dealer. And I'm passing the pipe back and forth to Tex, and I'm telling Tex, hey, Tex, I think the end is near, man. I think the cops are going to come get me pretty soon. You see, 10 days before this guy I've been doing all these burglaries with in Dallas, this guy named Dustin, had been picked up by the Dallas Police Department. So they're putting the screws to this guy. I know it's a matter of time before they get to me. And just as I passed the pipe back to Tex, I heard a window shatter off to my right. And tumbling across my living room floor is this little canister going end over end. And it starts to register what's going on in my mind. It's like a slow motion reel from a movie. Man, as I got up off the couch and I got over this thing and bam! The flashbang grenade goes off my face, y'all. Bright white light, loud noise, pulls me back on the couch. And when I came to, when I could see and hear again, this cop in full SWAT riot gear, man, he's got his boot on my chest, and the barrel of a machine gun is digging in my eye socket. And I can feel the barrel up against my eyeball, y'all. It's stinging. It's so cold. And he's got his finger hovering above the trigger, and he's screaming at me, don't move, don't move. Man, I looked up at this cop, and I blinked, and I was like, man, don't worry, you know, don't worry. Cops started flooding my apartment, man, and they've got, you know, they got me pinned down. I can see a bunch of boots moving around, but I heard one of them scream out, we got him. We got the Uptown Burglar. The Uptown Burglar, y'all. That's the moniker, the name I will have to live with for the rest of my life, the Uptown Burglar. You see, about a dozen other meth addicts and myself, young and old, male and female, black and white, and everything in between, because drugs don't discriminate, do they? Addiction doesn't discriminate. Doesn't care who you are, man, and where you come from, who your mom and dad are, what your socioeconomic status is. Addiction doesn't care. It's got you. When it's got you, it's got you. And so, but we as a burglary crew, about a dozen of us, indiscriminately, and without reservation, broke into the homes of dozens of people in the uptown neighborhood of Dallas and beyond in Dallas to feed our insatiable meth habits. But on July 30th, 2008, the Uptown Burglaries came to an end. That's the day they had their man. They had me zipped out of the floor of that apartment. They took me downtown, threw me into the county jail. They processed me in, gave me this mugshot, put me in a holding cell where I spent the first 24 hours of my incarceration of what I had no clue was going to be a long incarceration. And that first 24 hours in jail, I had one thought going through my head, and it wasn't about my victims, who I've got dozens of these at this point, y'all. I've created so many victims along the way. It wasn't about my family. I told you, families get it the worst. I put my family through hell. It wasn't even about myself, y'all. I've got a first-degree felony for organized crime hanging over my head with a potential life sentence in prison. I care about one thing that first 24 hours. What is that? That dope, man. How am I going to get that dope? I love coming into recovery crowds, man. This is good. Inside of prisons, inside of recovery rooms, people can answer that question right away. You go in front of a college football team, maybe not so much, but we know the drill. So I'm bouncing that thought around in my head for 10 months as I'm waiting to go to trial. And at the end of 10 months, a jury of my peers listens to all the evidence. I get my day in court. Actually, I got 6 days in court. And y'all, 6 days is a long criminal trial in the state of Texas for crimes that are not aggravated, crimes where no one was physically present. No one was even home during these burglaries. And at the end of 6 days, the jury of my peers deliberated on my sentence for a whole 10 minutes. 10 minutes, y'all. I don't know how much Law and Order you watch, but if a jury's gone for 10 minutes, they smoked you. And when I came back in that courtroom, that judge was smiling as he gaveled it in. He, bam, bam, bam. Damon Joseph West, you are hereby sentenced to 65 years in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, y'all. 65, y'all. That's life. Anything 60 and above is life on the Texas scale of parole. So a jury of my peers gave me life. My first felony conviction, y'all, I got 65 years. And y'all, that was a wake-up call for me. That is what I call rock bottom. I'll talk to you about my book in a little while, but the first chapter of my book starts out of that trial, May 18th, 2009. And I want y'all to remember the date, May 18th, because at the end I'm going to tell you about another May 18th. So May 18th, 2009, I was sentenced to life in prison. And it didn't have to be that way, y'all. I had every opportunity, every advantage in life. I came from a wonderful home. I grew up in a town called Port Arthur. Do y'all know where Port Arthur is? I know you know where Port Arthur is. Anybody know it? Somebody know? Somebody back there from PA? All right. You're not from PA? Okay, girl, because I'm looking. I'm like, do I know you? So, no. Port Arthur, down where Louisiana, Texas meet on the Gulf Coast down there in southeast Texas. Came from a great home. My dad was a sports writer there for almost 50 years. He was the first sports writer in that part of the state of Texas to put black athletes on the front page of the football section. And that was 1971 when he first did that. And he's got a box of hate mail. It was Joe Washington. He's got a box of hate mail at home to prove what that decision was like, because he wanted his kids, my older brother, my younger brother, to know what it was like to take a stand and do the right thing in life. And my mom, Jenny, is a nurse. I've got a wonderful family, nice-knit, happy family. But we've got our problems. I'll give you an example. In 1985, I was 9 years old. I came out and told my parents that my babysitter had been molesting me. And this is childhood sexual abuse back in the 80s, y'all. They didn't know as much about it back then as they know now. Hell, they didn't do as much about it back then as they did now. My parents went and talked to the police department, but the police said, because it's a female babysitter and your son's a male, well, we're not going to do anything about that. This is 85, though, y'all. You know, so my parents sent me to counseling. They sent me to talk to family priests, and we prayed about it, because prayer was what my mom went to. My parents are still alive. My mom's one of those moms that has a prayer plaque or a cross in every room in the house, man. And she is warding things off in every room, y'all. She's got crosses everywhere. So to this day, you can't escape God in my mom's house. But something inside that little 9-year-old boy went to a really dark place. And by the time I was 10 is when I got into substance abuse for the first time. And being in recovery now, I know that this is what's called the activating event. And so when I'm 10, I start drinking. I was getting my dad's beer. I start sneaking drinks from friends' houses that have liquor cabinets. I'm smoking cigarettes, a lot of adult behaviors. By the time I'm 12, I'm smoking pot. I'm into criminal addictive behavior now. I'm doing drugs at 12 years old. But because I could throw a football really well, man, I got a lot of breaks cut to me in life. This is Texas, man. We love our high school football in Texas, don't we? That's right, man. So I was a 3-year starter for my high school football team in Port Arthur, 5A team, Port Arthur Yellow Jackets high school team. I got a scholarship to play football at the University of North Texas, about 6 hours away in Denton. And when I got to college, the wheels came off, y'all, because I didn't have that protective environment around me anymore. And we're all addicts. We understand how this works. The worst part about my life at this point is I've got a bad belief system. And my bad belief system tells me that all I'm doing is drinking a little beer, smoking a little pot. I don't know what the big deal is. Why are all these people so upset? And the problem with a bad belief system is, and we know this in here, a bad belief system, the longer you hold on to one of those things, the harder it is to shake one of them, isn't it? And our bad belief system usually went out in the end. I learned that in cognitive intervention when I was in prison. A bad belief system usually wins out in the end, y'all. So I've got this bad belief system I took with me to college. And when I get to college, I really care about two things. That's playing, being the starting quarterback for my Division I team, and partying. And I do both really well. But life hands these days to us that I like to call fork-in-the-road days. And these fork-in-the-road days are days that you get knocked down so hard that when you get up and dust yourself off, you're at a crossroads. And the world looks different. You got hit so hard. And things are in different places. But you got a choice to make. And life is all about choices. And there's consequences that come with every choice. And so I came to a big fork in the road in life on September 21st, 1996. against Texas A&M. Instead of me telling you about it, let me show you this fork in the road.
David West is the starting quarterback. Cromers is running back. They go with a single set back, two flankers, two tight ends. They go on a play action back to the 20, now to the 25. Now he'll run with it. West across the 35 to about the 37. And they will come out and show a shotgun facing a second down and four from their own 37-yard line. A running back on either side takes the snap, delay out of the backfield, and that should be Hunt Allred, and it is. Allred goes to about the 39-yard line. He'll be too shy of a first down. One of the linebackers for Texas A&M, Dat Wynn, a top 100 high school recruit, just made the hit for the Aggies. Again, a shotgun for Damon West, a running back Allred off to his left. Here's the snap. He drops back to about the 32, throws in the flats to Coleman. He makes the reception, and he will be bottled up at the line of scrimmage. He caught it behind the line at about the 38. He got to the 39, and that will be it.
That will be it. Dave South, the legendary announcer from Texas. We got any Aggies in here? The legendary announcer from Texas A&M, Dave South. Come on now. We don't want to do that. So Dave is saying that will be it. Dave's talking about the end of the series, man. We went three and out, had to punt. But when I hear Dave say that will be it, I think about my college football career. That was the last play I ever played in college. I was 20 years old, starting quarterback for North Texas. Went down that game with a separated shoulder. Never played college football again. And when I got up at that fork in the road in life, man, everything looked different. Because all I did was play sports. My identity was wrapped up in being the quarterback. And when that was gone, man, I got lost. I had what I call in front of me an existential vacuum. And that's not my term. I borrowed that term from a guy named Viktor Frankl. And if you've never read Viktor Frankl's stuff, you should. It's really good stuff. But the existential vacuum in my life is this hole, this void where everything important was, and now it's gone. I've got to fill that with something. But instead of me filling it with good things, with positive things, I fill it with negative things. And that bad belief system kicked in. And instead of just smoking a little pot, drinking a little beer, man, now I'm putting in the hardcore stuff, cocaine, ecstasy, pills, you name it. If it was a drug that could change the way I felt and get me away from being Damon West, who I didn't enjoy being anymore, I was doing it. Somehow I graduated college in 1999. I moved off to Washington, D.C. I got a job working in Congress. Worked for a congressman from Houston. I worked in Congress for a couple years. I worked for a guy running for president of the United States in 2004 when he dropped out of the race. I moved back to Dallas, Texas to train to be a stockbroker for one of the biggest Wall Street banks in the world, UBS, United Bank of Switzerland. And it was at that job as a broker that I learned about different financial instruments with which to invest your money, you know, stocks and bonds and mutual funds. But the thing I enjoyed the most was commodities. And a commodity in the stock world is something like oil, like gold, platinum, silver. Those are commodities. You can trade those things. They're tangible things you can touch. But I learned about two commodities in life that are traded on the life exchange, not the stock exchange. And these two commodities are misery and time. That first one on the board, misery, pay close attention to, because misery is the only thing in life that's free, y'all. And you can have all of it you want. And when you're out of misery, all you do is tell life, give you more, and life will give it to you by the truckload. But that other, yeah, we all know that in here, right? But that other commodity on the board, time is antithetical to misery because it's the most precious resource in the world. And once it's gone for good. All the money in the world can't buy one more second of time. Let me tell you about misery and time. So I'm at that job as a broker in 2004. I'm passed out of my desk one day sleeping at work. And another one of the brokers comes up and sees me sleeping. He kind of freaks out. He wakes me up, man, startles me. He says, Damon, man, wake up. You can't sleep in this job, man. They'll fire you. You're messing with people's money. He said, man, come on out to the parking garage. I got something's going to pick you up. So I hop up out of my seat. I think we're going to the parking garage, go do a little cocaine because cocaine's my thing in 04, man. That's what I'm into at that point. We get in his car, and we get in there, and he hands me this glass pipe with these little crystal rocks in it clinking around. And I freak out on him at first. I'm like, man, what is that? He said, man, just relax, Damon. He said, it's crystal meth. He said, you'll love this stuff. Y'all, truer words had never been spoken. I fell in love with that drug that day, y'all. And then I freely gave everything away for that drug. I freely gave it away. My job, my home, my car, my savings account, my tethering to God, my family. I went from working on Wall Street to living on the streets of Dallas. So now I'm homeless, y'all. Sometimes I'm living in dope houses with all these other meth addicts. And all we do is sit around and get high all day long. Talk about we're going to get higher and higher. But we have a fundamental problem with our operation. We don't have jobs. So what do we do for our drugs? We steal, man. That's what we do. We do whatever we have to do. That's what addicts do. We do whatever it takes, right? Right. So we start breaking into cars. We start breaking into storage units. Then we start breaking into people's homes. And y'all, this burglary stuff I'm talking about, when you break into someone, not you, You didn't break in anybody's home. I did, man. It's accountability. It's part of one of the premises of our recovery is accountability. When I broke into these people's homes, when I broke into my victims' homes, I didn't just steal these people's property. I did. We stole over $1 million worth of property in 3 years of the Uptown Burglaries, y'all. I stole something way more valuable than that. They can replace some of that. I stole these people's sense of security, man. And I don't know if they ever get that back, y'all. They have to live with that for the rest of their lives, and so do I. But because I have a program of recovery today, I can process that. I can work through the steps, the eighth and ninth step. I can never make apologies to my victim. The state of Texas says that's a felony to ever try to make apologies. So I have to be careful never to try to make an apology to them, but I can go out and make what's called a living amends. And a living amends is where you go out and do service work. Today is a living amends. Today, the opportunity to share my story with y'all today is a living amends. And so these burglaries, they go on for 3 years. But on July 30th, 2008, the Dallas SWAT team put an end to the Uptown Burglaries, y'all. And that wasn't just a day I was arrested. Man, that was a day I was rescued, y'all. God got me out of a situation I couldn't get myself out of, y'all. So now we're back where the story started, in that holding cell, the first 24 hours in Dallas County. Anybody ever been in Dallas County Jail? It's no fun, no fun. So, not that any jail is fun, but Dallas County Jail particularly wasn't fun. So, after 24 hours in that holding cell, they come to get me, and they put me in one of the worst pods they could find, man. I think they did. They put me in a worse pod. Man, it was bad. Within 24 hours of that, I'm in my first fight in county jail over a breakfast tray, y'all. And so, look at me, too. I'm not a big guy. I'm in county jail, and man, it's like sharks with blood in the water. I'm freaking out scared, y'all. I'm so nervous about being in here. I'm freaking out. And all I want to do is call home and talk to my mom and dad. So they got those phones in the day room. So I went one day and picked one up a couple of days in the jail. And I call home down to Port Arthur, 6 hours away. And my dad answers the call. And my dad's from an older generation of men. He's in his 70s, man. I've never, ever seen my dad cry. But I heard him cry one time. That was whenever he answered that phone. And a lot of people in here know what that phone call is like, right? Man, my dad is screaming and crying in that phone. He sounds like a wounded animal, y'all. I can only recognize my dad. Damon, how we go so wrong, man. How we mess up so bad with you. And what could we have done different, man? So he's crying. And, man, now I'm crying because I broke my old man. So my mom gets on the phone. My mom, man, my mom's a nurse. She's used to traumatic situations in life. So she snatches the phone out of my dad's hand. She says, baby, listen, your dad can't talk right now. She said, I've never seen your dad like this before in my life. She said, but we need to have a serious conversation, Damon. She said, the first thing you need to understand is that we'd love you unconditionally, Damon. That's the family of the addicts, right? They love us so much, we become their addiction, don't we? Yeah. She says, we love you unconditionally, Damon. She said, there's nothing you can do to make us not love you. She said, that was the deal we made with God when he loaned you to us. She said, do you understand, Damon, that we love you unconditionally? And through the tears, I told my mom, I was like, yeah, Mom, I got it. Did you love me unconditionally? I understand. She said, that's good, baby, because we just gave you back to God. She said, there's nothing we can do for you anymore, Damon. She said, and I'll never forget what she said. She said, you are now a captive audience to God, and you better start listening. Jail's pretty much a captive place to be, right? About as captive as you get. So she said, you better start listening. And then she asked me a question. She said, Damon, do you remember that prayer plaque that I had on your wall as a kid growing up? Remember I told you my mom had these in every room in the house, right? But she's talking about the one that was above my bed in my bedroom on Roanoke Street where I grew up in Port Arthur. And y'all, I've been on this dope for 4 years, man. My brain's fried, man. I don't remember any. I was like, Mom, what are you talking about? What prayer plaque? She said, baby, it's footprints in the sand. She said, do you remember the story of footprints in the sand? And I was like, Mom, I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about? So she patiently and lovingly retold me the story of footprints in the sand about a guy walking the beach with God. And this is a room of recovery. You put anything you want, whatever your God is in there. She said, the guy's walking the beach with God. They're watching the video of his life play out in the sky. And she said, every time something good happened in that man's life, there's two sets of footprints walking side by side. Things are going well. She said, but every time something bad happened, when there's pain, there's hurt, there's suffering, there's loss, when he loses that football career, guy saw one set of footprints. So she said, finally, the guy couldn't take it anymore. So he calls God out and says, God, what's up, man? Every time something good happens in my life, man, you're walking with me side by side. But when stuff starts happening, man, you keep abandoning me. I can see one set of footprints. And she said, that's when God laughed and said, man, Damon, you fool. Every time you saw one set of footprints, I didn't abandon you. I carried you, boy. She started screaming like a football coach. She said, Damon, look down that jail cell. She said, there's one set of footprints in there, and they're not yours. She said, get on God's back. I don't want to lose my son. So, y'all, that night I started talking to a guy that I hadn't talked to in 12 years, man, when I got hurt playing college ball. And this isn't some kind of religious story, some kind of road to Damascus moment, man. This isn't a jailhouse conversion story. I'm still an addict in my addiction, y'all. I'm trying to find dope when I'm in jail. As a matter of fact, I get on my knees every night in county jail. Get on my bunk, right? Get on my knees at that bunk. I'd say the same prayer for 10 months waiting to go to trial. Dear God, please, get me out of this jam. And if you do, bargaining with God, right? Ever work for anybody? Like, God waits for me to get up every morning and run the universe. Boy, I sure hope Damon gets up. No, man. He doesn't need me. Man, dear, here it is. Dear God, please, get me out of this jam. If you do, I'm going to be a normal guy again. I'm going to get a job, and I'll just smoke meth on the weekends. I got this. Yeah. Spam email, y'all. Spam. It's one of those messages you don't even open. He never even opened that email. I know for sure he never got that message because when I went to trial 10 months later and that judge said 65 years, it took my breath. It took my mom's breath away. She was on the front row of the courtroom. My whole family was. And after the judge said 65 years, I heard my mother go, the sound only a mother can make when she hears her son get a life sentence in prison, y'all. And after that, it sped up on me, man. The sheriffs were on me. The bailiffs were on me. They slammed my arms by my back, put the cuffs on me, and shoved me out of that courtroom head first. And I'm wiggling out of that courtroom. All I can think to say to my mom, my family in the front row is, I'm sorry, Mom. And they take me, and they put me in this real little room on the side of the courtroom. It's got a bulletproof glass. You don't know the room if you've ever been in jail. You know the room right there. And so they sit me down and tell me to wait. They're going to give my parents one last visit with me before I go to prison, man. They just saw me get life, right? So my parents come in about 5 minutes later. My dad walks in. He's in stunned. He's stoic, man. He's in stunned disbelief. He just saw his son, with all this promise in life, get a life sentence in prison. So my mom does all the talking. My mom, man, she's got a steel spine, y'all. She's tough. She's been a nurse all of her life. So she sits down. She looks me in the eyes. She says, baby, she said, debts in life demand to be paid. And she said, you just got hit with one hell of a bill from the state of Texas. She said, but you did the things they said you did at that trial, Damon. So you got to go pay that debt to society. And debts demand to be paid, don't they, y'all? We got to pay those debts. Eventually they come up, and it may take a while, but she said, it's caught up with you now, Damon. You got to pay that debt. She said, but you owe your father and I a debt too, Damon. She said, we gave you all the opportunities in life, all the love and support to be anything you want to be in this life, and this is the life you chose. She said, that's not going to work, Damon. She said, we raised you in Port Arthur, Texas, a giant melting pot of a city. She said, we gave you a great moral compass, which you chose to not use. So here's the debt you're going to pay to us. She said, when you go to that prison, she said, you will not get one of these white hate groups, one of these Aryan Brotherhood type gangs, because you're scared because you're the minority in there. She said, that's not going to work, Damon. She said, you were never raised to see race. You're not going to start now. She said, when you go to that prison, Damon, you're not getting any tattoos on that skin of yours. Y'all look, man. I tell people all the time. Man, I was in the joint for almost 10 years, y'all. I did 7 years and 3 months in that life sentence. I'll tell you more about the parole process later, but man, I was in there for almost 10 years. And anybody that's ever been to prison knows they want to tattoo every inch of your body in there, don't they? They'd be like, man, Wes, let me put a tat on you. I'd be like, man, fool, my mom said no. So my mom said, she said, no gangs, no tattoos. She said, you come back as the man we raised or don't come back at all. Tough love for mom. Y'all have had these conversations before. A lot of people in this room know what that conversation is like. She said, do you understand this debt you're going to pay? And through the tears, I told my mom, I said, yeah, Mom, I got it. I understand it. But I had no clue, y'all. I'd never been to prison before. So when I get back to the pod in county jail, man, I'm running around county jail asking everybody I can that's been to the joint, man, how am I going to survive this? And every single guy I run into, man, everybody, black, white, Asian, Hispanic, is telling me the same thing. Man, you just got hit with a life sentence, Wes. You're going to the worst part of the Texas prison system where everybody in the building you live on has life, man. It's called a life sentence building, man. You're a G3 inmate. I said, man, you better get into a gang. You're 33 years old, man. Get into a gang. Let the gang fight for you. They said, you don't come off the building for 5 years, man. The G3 people, the lifetime offenders, you don't come off the building for the first 5 years in prison. I said, man, get into a gang, man. Let the gang fight for you. But there was this one guy, this older African-American guy named Mr. Jackson. And Mr. Jackson was in his 60s. He was a career convict, man, a seasoned criminal, man. This guy been to prison 4 or 5 times, but he was a real positive dude. And he'd come up every morning and check on me, man, make sure I was doing okay. So one particular morning, he comes up to me. He said, Wes, man, I've been watching how you're dealing with these knuckleheads, these dummies, man. Talk about you got to get into a gang. He said, do not listen to these fools. He said, but let me lace you up with prison. Let me tell you what prison's going to be like. He said, the first thing you need to understand about prison is all about race. He said, race runs the entire institution. He said, it's the most disgusting place you've ever seen in your life, man. He said, so don't get into a wreck over race. He said, and because you don't want to get into one of these gangs, he said, you're going to fight all the white gangs first. He said, if you survive all that, you don't give in to the ideology of hate out of fear. He said, you're going to fight the black gangs. So they're going to send the black gangs after you to try to get you to come back to them because that's what you're supposed to do if you're white. He said, but if you don't give in to all that, you will earn the right to walk alone. He said, the strongest man in prison always walks alone. He said, but let me tell you about prison fighting. This is the lesson of life. He said, you don't have to win all your fights. But you do have to fight all your fights. That's a lesson in life, y'all. You're going to lose sometimes in life. But Jax is telling me, man, you don't have to win those fights you get into, but you do have to fight those fights. He said, don't ever turn down a fight in the life sentence building, man. They will devour you. He said, and he saw me struggling with this still, because I'm not understanding about this whole idea of fighting and losing and having to fight all having to fight so much, and I'm not built like that. He says, Wes, I want you to imagine prison is like a pot of boiling water. He said, anything we put in that pot of boiling water is going to be changed by the heat and the pressure inside that pot. He said, I want to put three things in that pot of boiling water we call prison and watch how they change. A carrot, an egg, and a coffee bean. He said, first things first. He said, Wes, if I put a carrot into that pot of boiling water we call prison, he said, what happens when you boil a carrot? Good job, y'all. Good job. Turns soft. He said, that's right, Wes. He said, the carrot goes to prison hard, but the water changed that prison, changed that carrot, beat him down quick. He said, the carrot got beat, he got robbed, he got raped, and he may have gotten killed. He said, you do not want to be the carrot inside of prison. He said, what about the egg, Wes? What happens to the egg? What happens when you boil an egg, y'all? Good job, y'all. Jackson said, it gets hard, man. He said, the egg had a hard outer shell, so physically the egg is fine. Eggs are always fine physically, he said. But inside, that soft, liquid core, his heart turned hard, just like it did on the outside. He said, if your heart becomes hardened, you're incapable of giving or receiving love. He said, if you're incapable of giving or receiving love, you have become institutionalized. He said, you will not come back as someone your parents recognize because your eggshell has swastikas on it now. He said, what about that coffee bean, West? And I had no clue what happened to a coffee bean in a pot of boiling water. And Mr. Jackson laughed at me. He said, you know, for a college boy, you're not too smart. All that education doesn't matter now, does it? He said, for a college boy, you're not too smart. He said, West, if I put a coffee bean in that pot of boiling water we call prison, he said, now you got to change the name of the water to coffee. He said, that coffee bean, the smallest of these three things, he said, small like you, West, had the power to change the entire atmosphere inside that pot. He said, everybody in life puts out energy, negative or positive. He said, whatever kind of energy you put out, you attract back. He's explaining to me what's called the law of attraction. He said, if you want to walk around prison all the time with a negative look on your face, a frown and a mean mug all the time, he said, you're going to attract that same kind of inmate. He said, that could be a very dangerous, even deadly endeavor in there. He said, but West, if you walk around that prison with a smile on your face and you let those guys know they're not getting to you, no matter what they do, they're not getting to you, he said, you will change that prison from the inside out. He said, the best part about it is the other coffee beans in prison, the other positive inmates will find you because of your energy. And the last thing Mr. Jackson told me, he said, when you get out there, West, you get to that prison, he said, go out there and go be that coffee bean. And man, with that, I was off. My whole world changed in August of 2009. I became inmate West number 158-5689. Anybody got one of these in their pocket? Yep. You had a bad day if you got one of those, didn't you? That's a bad day. Anytime you get one of those in your pocket, you had a bad day, y'all. That's as bad as it gets. Texas Department of Criminal Justice. Everything about the prison experience was awful, y'all. Especially the ride down there on the Bluebird, being handcuffed to another man. You know, it's a 10-hour bus ride. He goes to the bathroom. One or two, you're going with him, man. He gets in a fight, you get in a fight, you got one arm the whole time you're fighting, because you're handcuffed on the other one, y'all. It's crazy. You get there, they shave your head, they process you in, they poke you, they prod you. Then they send you to your unit of assignment. My unit of assignment is the Mark Stiles unit in Beaumont, Texas, man. And this is a mixed bag for me, because Stiles is in Beaumont. So Beaumont's right next to Port Arthur. So it's good because I'm going to be home. I'll be close to my parents. I can see my family all the time. But it's bad because it's Stiles, y'all. And if you don't know anything, you Google Stiles sometime. I put the Mark Stiles unit against any prison in America, y'all. It's a tough place to do time. But prison by design is a punishment, isn't it? Prison's hard. So I get to Stiles, and Mr. Jackson had told me what it was going to be like when you first get in there. He said, when you first get into prison, he said, do not be like those guys that are scared and run to their cells. He said, do not run to your cell. He said, I've never been to the life sentence part of the prison system. He said, but it's going to be just like the same as all prison. That heart check, that first fight you get into, is going to set the tone for the rest of the time you're there. He says, when you get in there, he said, put your bags down, put your back against the wall, wait for it to happen. He said, it won't take any time. So I did, man. He said, the first guy that comes up to you, he said, that guy's not coming to hurt you. He's an information gatherer, man. He's going to be a white guy. He's going to want to know what gang you're riding with. He said, get him out of your face, man. Tell him you're riding with God. He said, but that second guy that comes up to you, he's coming to hurt you, man. He said, when he gets within range, put your fist in his mouth. And so when I got to the Stiles unit on January 14th, 2010, I walk into the pod. They take me there. I'll never forget my first housing assignment. 7-building, G-pod, 2-section, 45-cell, bottom bunk. So much terror around those first 2 months in prison. I walk in the pod, y'all, and they close the doors behind me. It's the loudest thud in the world. Anybody that's ever been to prison knows that loud. Doom, doom. I look up, and they've got these three tiers, man. It's this giant, massive room, and all these inmates are hanging around, and it's loud. I remember prison was so loud. It's like living on an aircraft carrier. And, man, it got real silent when I walked in there. Every set of eyeballs is on me in there. So I set my mattress down, set my bags down on the ground, put my back against the wall, and waited, man. Here he comes. 10 minutes, man. Just like Jackson said. A little bitty white dude, man. He's got this meth mouth thing going on. He's got swastikas tattooed all over him. He's drunk. He's been drinking on that hooch. I could smell the wine on him. You know, he comes up. He gets in my face. He says, "Hey, white boy, what family you riding with, white boy?" I said, "Man, get out of my face, little dude. I'm riding with God. Y'all just leave me alone." He laughed at me. He said, "Man, God didn't hear it, man. We kicked him out a long time ago." He said, "But we're here, white boy. We're coming to get you, man." So he stumbles off, and I was like, man, I'm thinking to myself, that did not go well, y'all. And so, no. 10 minutes later, man, here he comes. Biggest corn-fed white dude I've ever seen in my life. This guy was a giant, man. He's coming down the stairwell on the right in this pod, man. And he's got muscles and veins ripping out of his shirt. And he's got a big swastika tattooed on top of his big skinhead, dude. Big swastika tattooed on top. And he's coming down like this, y'all. And y'all, I played sports all my life, man. I can be coached. I know how to be coached. I remember what Jackson said. Man, when he got within range, I hit that dude in the grill as hard. I popped him in the mouth as hard as I could. In 20 seconds, man, that fight was over. That dude had me on the ground, beating me down, man. Y'all thought I was going to tell you I beat that dude up? Come on, man. Some little white guy goes to prison and starts running stuff? Yeah, that's called Rocky. That's a movie, y'all. That's Hollywood. That's not real life. Let me tell you about real life, y'all. I probably got in 36 fights the entire time I was locked up, from county jail to under prison. And I lost, physically lost, 75% of those fights, y'all. I got my butt kicked a lot. But I got up and fought. Because Jackson said, you don't have to win those fights, but you have to fight those fights. And I got up every day, and I got up, and I learned more about myself from my losses, because you can inspect a loss and learn stuff from it. And I learned that I've been putting limits on myself, y'all. I got so scared sometimes, man. Sometimes when they rolled those doors for chow or day room or rec yard or anything, I wouldn't go because I was so scared I was going to hear someone say, "Hey, Wes, I want to look at you in the shower." Anybody that's been in the joint knows what's going to happen then, man. You're not going. There's nothing gay about that, y'all. Someone wants to look at you in the shower, you're going to box because there's no guards back there, no cameras. You clean that blood out of the shower real easily. So, man, I got tired of putting limits on myself, y'all. I'm about 6 weeks into it. It took me 2 weeks to get through the white gangs. Now I'm fighting the black gangs, sometimes more than one at a time. So one Monday morning, man, I get up and I look in that dingy old mirror and I don't like the guy I see looking back at me, man, because that guy's been putting limits on himself. Let me tell you something. Nobody can put limits on you but you, y'all. Don't let anybody tell you what you can or cannot do. Man, the only person to put limits on you is you. And if you allow somebody to do it, that's on you too. So one Monday morning, I get up and I look in that cell, that mirror, and I say that sentence at the bottom, man. If it is to be, it is up to me. That's the most powerful sentence in the English language, y'all. It's 20 letters and 10 words of pure power because it's a permission statement. It tells you to get up and go do something. That Monday morning, I went to the rec yard, y'all. And remember me telling you about Jackson saying prison is all about race? Anybody that's been there knows what I'm talking about. Man, this rec yard on the life sentence building, the Styles Unit, it's the most segregated place I've ever seen in my life, y'all. I'm going to walk you through the rec yard real quick. So you come in through this little chute, the door. And they strip you down butt naked, man, because they're checking for knives and dope or anything else you got, phones. So they strip you down. You come in. We'll call that home plate. Right field, man. They got a sand volleyball court. Whites and Hispanics only. No blacks allowed. Come on down the left field. Left center field, they got these big handball walls, these giant 30-foot walls. Everybody can play handball, y'all. All the races can play. But you want to partner up, play doubles? I mean, your partner better have the same skin color as you, same race, right? Come on down the third baseline. They got the weight stack. Guys in prison want to lift weights. I get that, man. All the races can lift weights. But in the life sentence building, your spotter, your partner, better look like you. Better be the same race as you. I pass all that up that day, y'all. I'm going to earn some respect, and I'm fighting the black gangs at this point. So I head straight to the basketball court. Who do y'all think runs the basketball court? The brothers, man. And they run it. They run it. Y'all, I played sports all my life, and I'm from Port Arthur, man. I've been the only white guy on the west side playing basketball before. So check this out, man. There's no white guys allowed in that basketball court, but they got a flaw in their system, and I found it. After 2 weeks of watching these games, that's what inmates do, man. We sit around and watch and watch and watch. And I found the flaw. After every game they play, they're going to shoot for teams. Y'all know what shoot for team captains means? It means the first two guys to make shots get to be captains. So I know if I get my hands on that basketball, I can be a team captain. I can play some basketball. Because if I'm going to fight these guys, I'm unable to fight playing sports. I'm an athlete. So I get out there, and I'm watching this basketball game. It's a lopsided game. And I know what side of the court the game's going to end on. And so I get off and I go underneath that basket. And everybody's looking at me, man, because I'm not even supposed to have my feet on this court, man. Everybody's like, what the hell is that white boy doing, man? And as soon as that basketball went to the last basket for the last point, I went and fell on that basketball like a fumble drum football. Y'all, I got this ball locked up, and the whole basketball court sucked up around me. Man, just a sea of angry black faces. They are pissed, man. They're like, hey, white boy, man, give us our ball back, man. We're going to hurt you for this. I said, man, in the toughest voice I could, I was squeaking and cracking my voice. Y'all are going to have to hurt me, man, because I'm playing basketball today. I'm shooting for teens, man. And I mean, they can see the panic in my eyes, man. I'm like this. And man, now they're screaming at me. They're spitting on me. Man, we're going to kill you for this, man. Don't you know we have to kill you now? And so, man, I'm holding this ball. And the biggest dude out there, man, this blood from Houston named J-Bud, man. J-Bud gets up in my face, and I think he's going to knock me out, y'all. But he's going to get a free shot because I'm not letting that ball go. J-Bud gets up in my face. He says, you know what, white boy, get up on the line and shoot that shot, man. I hope you make it. And, man, the basketball court parted, and that free throw line popped up. It looked like the equator was so big, man. So I went up to this line, and here's the score. Here's what's about to happen, y'all. If I miss this shot, they're going to kill me because I didn't just disrespect the basketball court. Man, I disrespect an entire race. And I'm on an island, y'all. Man, the white guys are over there screaming, man, kill him, man, kill him. You know? But if I make it, they're going to hurt me, man. They don't want me out there. I don't belong. White guys don't belong in that basketball court, man. So I steal my nerve, man. If it is to be, it's up to me. And I drain my shot. Pew! Nothing but net. Step back. I'm a team captain, man. J-Boy gets up. He makes his shot. He's a team captain, too. We pick our teams. I pick my four guys. He picks his four guys. We got a little 5-on-5 going, right? Wrong. It's 9-on-1, y'all. 9-on-1. Man, my own teammates don't want me out there. And this is life sentence. This is basketball in the life sentence building, y'all. They don't have any guards in the tower. There's never been a guard in the tower up there. There's no referees, which means there's no fouls. You can punch, kick, scratch, bite, pull hair, whatever you want. Y'all, that first day I was out there, man, I'm flying down the basketball court, and dude took my legs right out from under me, man. I go flying on that concrete, man. I came out that first Monday. I got a black eye, busted lip. I'm sawed up from head to toe, but I survived. I came back out Tuesday, and when I came back out again, and I looked at that mirror on the way out again, if it is to be, it's up to me. And none of me wanted to go back out there and get a piece of that, man, but I had to, y'all. Had to go. So I get on the basketball court again, and these guys laughing at me, man. Hey, white boy, we thought you had enough yesterday. I said, man, hey, I thought you boys were playing basketball. What's up? Man, J-Boy said, you know what? Get on my team, white boy. You're playing with me today, man. So, y'all, if I was looking to play some basketball, I got what I was looking for. They picked me first every game after that. And I'm not first pick caliber, y'all. I'm not that good. But everybody wanted to get a piece of me at that point, y'all. And this went on, man. It was brutal. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, man, I'm out there. And they're knocking me around like a piñata. And I'm giving it back wherever I can, y'all. Because I'm out there to earn some respect. Saturday, man, we're out there in the basketball court. And I remember I was out there about half court, man. The reason why I'm at half court is because my team's on offense. I hadn't touched the ball since I shot that shot Monday, y'all. They don't even pass me. All I do is play defense. Yeah, real talk. So I'm out there half court. And I remember thinking, man, Damon, this is your life, man. You're going to do this for 65 years, man. All you're going to do is play basketball every day because you came out here and did this. It's stupid, man. I remember I wanted to kick myself. Just about that time, somebody passed me that basketball, man. I'm like, man, I didn't even know how to act. I dribbled up, shot it. I missed it, man. I was like, man, I hope they give me another shot. And so I'm out there again. They pass me the ball again. They're passing me the ball more now. And eventually, I make my shot. And then I heard it. I heard the change, y'all. Somebody yelled out, good shot, West. West. I got my name back. I wasn't a white boy anymore, you know. And a lot of people in this room knows what it feels like to be called by the color of your skin. Very derogatory thing. But they stopped doing it that day. Man, in 6 days, that all stopped, man. In 6 days, everybody became coffee beans in that basketball court. And after that game was over, man, they circled up around me like they did 6 days before. And J-Bud did all the talking again, man. He said, West, he said, man, you pulled something off out here. We had never seen a white boy pull off before. He said, man, you took everything we had. You gave it back, man, whatever you could, man. And you never got racial with us. You never called us any names. He said, man, you don't have to worry about the blacks the rest of the time you're in prison, man. You're good with us, man. And, man, that felt good, y'all. That felt good because I finally belong. But the first thing I thought about when he said that was Mr. Jackson. Mr. Jackson, that coffee bean story, y'all. And that's when I knew, man, Mr. Jackson, man, that dude, that old man knew what he was talking about. Because in 6 days, everybody made a change. You can't think about how difficult it was for me to be the only white boy out there. We get that, man. How difficult was it for them to have me on their basketball court? Some of them got 20 years of a bad belief system telling them I don't belong out there. But in 6 days, everybody made a change. And they come by my cell. They come by 45 cell every day after that. Knock on the cell. Man, come on, Wes. Let's go shoot some hoop. So, guys, I finally belong. And so my life was good after that point. But I got in one more fight after that. It was a fight in the shower. I had to fight for my life. But if you want to hear about the shower fight story, you got to read the book, The Change Agent. But luckily, we got some books to give away today. So, don't we, Don? Yeah, we got books to give away. Whew, I'm glad I made sure on that. Yeah. So 2 weeks after the basketball court, I get the drop that this guy's going to try to rape me in the shower, right? And so this guy that tells me about it, this little Hispanic guy from San Antonio, Carlos, man, Carlos tells me about it. He ends up giving me a weapon. I come out of that okay. And after that fight was over, y'all, after that fight was over, I never had to fight again the rest of the time I was in prison. But here's the deal, man. I'm 2 months into this prison stay, and I have become the egg. I know I've become the egg. And I don't want to be the egg. I want to be that coffee bean that Mr. Jackson talked about. I want to come home with someone my parents recognize, but prison devours people, y'all. It will devour you, will chew you up and spit you out, and I'm in there, man. I'm feeling it. So I'll go down to that chapel, y'all, because Mr. Jackson told me, he said a lot of coffee beans will be in that chapel. And I started finding the answers to all my questions. I started finding the solution. I got into recovery, y'all. I got in that first meeting. I remember the first time I signed up for an AANA meeting in prison. I got my little lay-in. Y'all know what a lay-in is? If you know what a lay-in is, you had a bad day too, right? A lay-in in prison is a little white slip of paper that tells you where to go. So I remember getting this lay-in. And this lay-in says, go to the chapel Wednesday morning at 7:30 a.m. for AANA. So I got to doing the numbers. I'm like, man, we got 3,000 guys in this unit, man. And 80% of us have substance abuse issues. Man, that's 2,400 people. The chapel's too small. We're going to have to have way bigger. We're going to have this meeting on the rec yard, y'all, because so many people are going to be at the AA meeting, right? We're going to need to go to the rec yard. They're going to need to bring guards in from another unit because it's going to be like a Rolling Stones concert, right? Wrong, man. When I got to that first meeting, I knew I was in the right place. There were 51 guys in that meeting. 51 out of 2,400. Got up today and decided they were going to do something different with their lives and start living in the solution instead of living in the problem. And that's when I knew I was in the right place. And that's where I learned how to become that coffee bean. I figured it out. There's about 5 ways to becoming that coffee bean. Y'all want to hear those 5 ways? 5 ways of becoming a coffee bean. I learned it inside of Max Security Penitentiary. Here it is. Way number 1. Your positive body language starts it all off, y'all. Everybody that sees you, that meets you, is going to be reading your body. Your body language speaks volumes before you ever open your mouth. Speaks 1,000 words. So put that positive body language. Put a smile on your face. Everywhere you go, smile. Smile. Because when you're in a room full of positive people, when I'm at the Austin Recovery today, and I'm watching all these people, all these alumni in here, and everybody hanging out, having a good time, man, I'm seeing all this positive energy. 2 things I know about negative people. When they're in a room full of positive people, they will either get with the positivity and become positive, or they will get out of the room. And either one is okay. So use that to your advantage, y'all. Coffee beans run around with a smile on their face all the time. Today, I get to go into prisons all over the state of Texas. I got a deal going with the state of Texas. I work with the prison system now. I go into all 104 prisons in Texas, do this presentation. And I go in there and I ask these guys, hey, man, whenever y'all were locked up, because you go to different units and people were there in the unit where you did time with you at your unit. I said, man, y'all remember me smiling? They're like, oh, man, you had a smile on your face all the time. That's because I wanted to be that coffee bean, y'all. So smile. The second rule about being a coffee bean is you got to get up every day and go get it, y'all. And I'm not talking about physically go work out. I'm talking about work out in 3 areas. Spiritually, mentally, physically. You have to get in shape and stay in shape. So what does it mean to do a spiritual workout? Anybody seen page 86 of the big book? Yeah. That means you have a conscious contact with your higher power every single night at the end of each day. And you ask questions like, do I owe someone an apology? Was I resentful? Was I a good human being today? What did I do to put back into the stream of life? Those are spiritual workouts, y'all. And you hold yourself accountable. When you owe those apologies, you make them. Then you got to also ask yourself, do I owe someone forgiveness? Because you know what? If you want forgiveness, you got to give it out. And that's the hard part. Resentments are good. I love my resentments, y'all. Ooh, I want to hold on to my resentments. But resentments are the number one offenders of addicts, y'all. So that spiritual workout is important every single day at the end of each night. And every morning, get up and have that spiritual workout. I learned how to pray in recovery in prison. And remember that crazy prayer I used to say in county jail when I was living my addiction? Man, when I got into the solution, I was living in recovery. I learned how to pray. I say the same prayer today that I learned how to pray in prison. It's a 2-part prayer. You can have it if you want it. I get on my knees every morning and say, God, put in front of me what you need me to do today for you, and let me recognize it when I see it. Because I don't want to miss that. And I don't pray for anything else, y'all. Because I know God, my higher power, will take care of everything I need. Maybe not what I want, but what I need. So that's my spiritual workout every day. Mentally working out. What does that mean to mentally work out? That means, man, what kind of stuff are you feeding yourself mentally? Because we are what we eat. You know, whatever you put in is what you look like on the outside. So put the right stuff in. What kind of books are you reading? What kind of videos do you watch? What kind of websites do you go to? Man, when I was in prison, I read a book every other day, probably. I read everything I could get my hands on. Man, fiction, nonfiction, history, biographies, the history of world religions. I got into the big book, and I learned about the 4 spiritual principles. Unselfish, honest, pure, and loving. Unselfish, honest, pure, and loving. This became a formula for my life to live my life with mentally. Because I could ask myself every single day at every decision I want to make. Damon, is what you're about to do, is it unselfish? Is it honest? Is it pure? Is it loving? And if it's not, that's a dangerous place for us addicts. Because you know why? It's on the other side of the spectrum over here. It's selfish, self-seeking, self-want, self-desire, self-delusion. Those are the things that derail us every day in addiction, y'all. So mentally work out. Physically work out. That means, man, take care of yourself. You get one body. Put the right stuff in. Get enough rest every day. You only get one body, y'all. You got to take care of it. So the third rule about being a coffee bean, and this is what I learned about in the rooms of recovery and in that chapel, in that prison, is the secret to life is serving others and being humble. It's called servant leadership. It's helping other people achieve their goals in life. And that's what we learn in recovery all the time. It's about doing service work, y'all. We got to find ways to go out there and help other people out. Find ways to put back into the stream of life every single day. Because when you're doing that, that's when you're really helping yourself. And that's how you stay sober. So the fourth rule about being a coffee bean is something I learned in the rules of recovery, in the rooms of recovery too. And it was at one of these meetings where we start off with, say, the serenity prayer. You know the serenity prayer in this room, right? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So I go to this meeting, and the guy running the meeting, this guy named Rocco. Rocco says, Damon, tell us what the serenity prayer means to you. So I get up, and I say something about, you know, picking your battles in life and being a good moral character. And he's like, you're wrong. Sit down. And so Rocco draws a line from one side of the chalkboard to the other. Boom. He said, that's God's line. He said, and God's line is infinitely long. It's bigger than that chalkboard right there. He said, God's line goes from one horizon of the universe to the next. He said, so stay off of God's line, because every time you try to touch something on God's line, you hurt yourself or you hurt others. He said, the first part of the prayer, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. He said, all the things you cannot change are on God's line. Then he went and erased a little inch out of God's line. And he held his fingers up an inch apart. He said, if God's line is infinitely long, your line is to scale. He said, you get one inch of that big line. He said, in that line, God gives you the four things you could work on. He said, the second part of the prayer, the courage to change the things I can. The things you can change, Damon West, he said, are four. There are exactly four things that you control in this life. He said, the four things you control are what you think, what you say, what you feel. He said, most importantly, because everybody's going to see this, what you do. And then he said, the last part of the prayer, the wisdom to know the difference between that and that line. He said, because as us addicts, we always mess it up. We want to touch stuff on that big line, and we don't mess with what's on that small line. Because that small line controls our lives, y'all. What you think, what you say, what you feel, what you do. And if you can get to that place in life where you just work on those four things that you control, those things where you have effect on, you will take off in life in the fast lane. And I sure did, y'all. When I was in prison, when I learned this lesson right here, that there's only four things I control, man, everybody took notice. The other inmates took notice, and my life had changed. The guards took notice. The parole board took notice. Y'all, I did 7 years and 3 months in the maximum security prison on that life sentence. And at the end of 7 years and 3 months, on November 16, 2015, parole came to see me. They said, man, we're going to give you, I was doing my last 6 months at the FI-5 unit right here in Kyle. Said, man, we're going to give you this one shot to go home. And the lady said, you know, she said, Mr. West, I don't see a lot of people come through like you. You had this amazing life in your past life. You've done all these amazing things in prison, this coffee bean thing. She said, I got one question for you. She said, if you could be remembered for being anything in this life, give it to me in just one word, go. And because I was in recovery, and because I was a coffee bean, I had her answer for her. I said, useful, ma'am. I just want to be useful. I said, I can be useful in this prison, or I can be useful out there finding coffee beans. And they let me go, y'all. She said, if you come back anywhere in this country in handcuffs again between now and 2073, we'll keep you until 2073. Y'all, I'm on paper till 2073. That means every single month I check in. And they even joke around at the law firm where I work at the law firm now. Isn't that crazy? Yeah. I work at a law firm. They joke around at the law firm. They said, Damon's the only employee here we know for sure is not on drugs, because I get tested every month. For the rest of my life. I mean, how great is that? And I can pass these. I don't even have to study for these tests. I'm good. But I learned in this new life what the fifth rule about being a coffee bean was. Because this new life has taught me so much. Because so many doors have been opened. God has opened so many doors for me. It is crazy, y'all. I got out of prison. The second day I was out, I'm working inside this prestigious law firm in Beaumont, Texas. Because I did my own legal work in prison. And these lawyers took notice of me from this firm. They said, when you get out of prison, come see us. We got a job for you. And they gave me that job. And after that, I got to go around and start speaking at schools locally in Port Arthur and Beaumont, in the area where I live. And eventually, I started speaking to college football programs. I met a guy named Dabo Swinney. Y'all know who Dabo Swinney is? Dabo put me on, man. Dabo got me speaking at Clemson and got me speaking at Alabama and all these other schools. I get to go all over the country and share my story with people all over the place. I get to go in prisons everywhere around the state of Texas now. I get to go to prisons all over the country. Rooms of recovery to share my story. I went back to school. I graduated in May. I graduated in May with a master's degree in criminal justice, y'all. I got a master's in criminal justice. Isn't that crazy? Yes. In fact, May 17th, 2019, all right? The day before the 10-year anniversary of getting sentenced to life in prison, I graduated with my master's in criminal justice, all right, from Lamar University. Gave the commencement speech at my own graduation. And the next day, on the anniversary, the 10-year anniversary of getting sentenced to life in prison, I got married to Kendall on May 18th, 2019. That's right. We got to replace that bad day, that life sentence, for a wonderful life. And, I'm not saying anything back to that. What a wonderful life sentence that is. Boy, this is good. Yeah. So, I've written two books. This book came out in March called The Change Agent, and that's my life story. And then this book right here, The Coffee Bean, that book came out in July. Last August, I'm sitting around my office at work at the law firm, and I get a call from this guy named John Gordon. Has anybody ever heard of John Gordon? He's a huge motivational speaker and author. John sold 4 million books. He's huge, man. Everybody on the speaker circuit knows who John is. John calls me up out of the blue. He said, "Hey, Damon, it's John Gordon." I'm like, "Man, first of all, how do you even have my number? How do you know who I am, John Gordon?" He said, "Man, Dabo Swinney can't quit talking about you and that coffee bean story." He said, "Man, that's all he talks about." He said, "Damon, I want to write a book with you called The Coffee Bean, man. I want to share that story all over the world." He said, "Write the book with me." I thought the guy was crazy. He said, "We'll split everything 50-50, man. Write the book with me." Y'all, that book came out in July. It was on the Wall Street Journal bestseller list for 7 weeks, y'all. This is the guy that's got a life sentence in prison. But because I have a program of recovery today, y'all, all these things are possible. The most important thing in my life is my program of recovery, y'all. Without that, I lose it all. Anything I put from that program of recovery, I lose, y'all. And that's when I learned what the fifth rule by being a coffee bean was. The fifth rule by being a coffee bean is your past does not define you. I don't care what you did in your past, y'all. Your past wins don't define you. Your past losses don't define you. Man, your past is your lesson, man. Learn from that. And anybody in here that's got a TDCJ number, you've been arrested, man, you could turn that liability into an asset because you got a story to tell. I've never met a strong person that has an easy past. And if you've got a prison ID in your pocket, you've been arrested, you've been an addict in your addiction, you got a story to tell. Use that story. Find a way to go out there and help other people with it, man. Serve other people because that's what the secret to life is. The secret to life is serving others and being humble. Your past is your lesson. The present today is a gift, man. If we talk about one day at a time in these rooms, that's all you can do is one day at a time. You know, whoever woke up first in this room today has the most amount of recovery. I don't care about the years and all that other stuff. It's a one-day deal, y'all. Your past is your lesson. Your present is a gift. And the future is your motivation. Motivate yourself with the right stuff, y'all. How do I become a better husband one day? A better mother, a better father, a better wife, a better future servant leader? Those are the things that should motivate us. So, y'all, look. I got this thing right here. A call to action. At the end of every presentation, I do what's called a call to action because you sat here for, 45 minutes, 50 minutes, and I'm sitting here talking to you about my story. But what is it without a call to action? Let me tell you what I need you to do. Your price of admission today is this. You go out there and you go share Mr. Jackson's coffee bean story, all right? But when you share Mr. Jackson's coffee bean story, don't tell him about a pot of boiling water that's prison, man. That's Jackson's story, that's my story, and that may be some of your story. But everybody out here is going to understand that pot of boiling water is life, and life is going to turn the heat up. And when it does, how will you respond? You tell them about that carrot, man. That carrot that turns soft and wilted. And, man, no one wants to be the carrot. But I've been the carrot. And so have you. It sucks. You tell them about that egg. The egg that turns hard. Let life beat it down. Turn hard to life, man. No one wants to be an egg. No one wants to be around the egg. I've been the egg, y'all. And I'm a miserable person when I'm the egg. And misery is free. It's the only thing in life that's free. The egg is miserable. But you tell them about that coffee bean. And when you talk about that coffee bean, man, put that expression on your face. Use that first rule about being a coffee bean, man. That positive body language and smile, man. You talk about this coffee bean, get excited. Because that coffee bean jumps into that pot of boiling water and says, "You know what? Turn it up. I got this." And that coffee bean, the longer it sits in that pot of boiling water, the stronger that pot of coffee is going to be, y'all. My call to action to you today, Austin Recovery, is you go out there and you go be that coffee bean, y'all. Thanks a lot, y'all. Thanks for letting me talk. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Don. Thank you. I got... Laura, my wife's grandmother makes these things at home. These are little coffee bean candles. It says be a coffee bean on the outside. It's got coffee beans on the inside and a candle. When you light the candle, the coffee bean aroma comes out of it. So I want you to have that for Awesome Recovery, and I want y'all to have books. I don't know if y'all have a library here, but I wanted to give y'all a copy of each book. So, and I'll sign them in a second for you and everything like that. Thank you for the opportunity today to be of service. Thank you very much. Thank you.